Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm going to talk now to two men who've been friends for 40 years and they've now tested that friendship by making an extraordinary, deeply personal film together. Alan Gilsonen and Tomás Hardiman, good morning.
Morning, Brendan. Morning, Brendan.
So, Alan, people will know you for your documentary films, and Tomás, you produced some of those films, but this new one, The Days of Trees, you are also the subject of, and the film looks at the fallout from abuse you suffered as a child, so listeners might want to use their discretion. Alan, can I start with you? We spoke recently when the great Maverick psychiatrist Ivor Brown died. And you and Tomás made that great film with him, Meetings with Ivor. And I think it was while making that, was it, that you noticed in your phrase that the wheels were coming off for Tomás. So what kind of guy was he before and what change did you notice in him?
Well, we met first when Tomás was working in the Abbey in PR and marketing and I was directing a play there. And Tomás was, you know, he was a playboy, I think it's fair to say. You know, he was the life and soul of any party. We were both great friends at Tom Murphy, the playwright. So my memories of Tomás was this very lively, you know, the man to go. If you wanted to go out late, you'd go with Tomás. And we stayed friends over the years. And then when we were making Meetings with Ivor, I mean, it wasn't obvious, but Tomás started to share with me, you know, that he felt, you know, as I've said, the wheels coming off a bit emotionally, psychologically. And in the course of making that film, or just after it, Tomás starts to see Ivor Brown in a more professional
way. So, Tomás, you had been aware of something, I think, over some years, a kind of a spectre rising in you at times, yeah?
Yeah, but like I hadn't a clue what it was, Brendan, really. Like, I kind of look upon my life like up until I was 55, I was having a kind of a so-called normal life, you know, totally normal. But I discovered as I went in, I had started some psychotherapy even in my 20s. So I was tipping away at something which I did not know. I didn't know the quality of it or whatever, but it was a case, I suppose, of, I see it now as having lived one life up until I was 55, but then discovering what was at the bottom of all my malaise was a very low-grade malaise that I came right through my life with, you know. I had a lot of anxiety and I had fear underneath, but of course that was covered up with, not necessarily bravado, but like, you know, life in the theatre and film and all that, you know, I kept everything going.
So you were a hail fellow, well-met kind of character.
I suppose, yeah. And, you know, again, in that sort of way, you know, if you have something to hide, you're always going to be gregarious to, like, you have to distract, number one, yourself from the matter and then distract everybody else. So I became a master at that, I suppose, in a way. But still, there was a genuine person at work all the time. But I kind of now see that there were two Tomases. And I didn't discover that until I was 55. And I think that's a very common thing, Brendan. I'm sure you've talked to other people and I've heard other people on the radio and stuff, you know, describe how they're in their 50s before this thing, if there's child abuse or any adverse childhood experience, that it actually raises its head fully. There's
so
little bits
that,
of fallout all the way. Yeah.
That 55 years then, is that a fake life? A wasted life? I mean, how do you look on it now?
It's good to ask that question. It's not at all, of course, like because I had a wonderful life in so many ways, but there was just a part of it which was a mystery to me, and it used to manifest itself in ways of, like, you know, the usual things that people describe, you know, panic attacks. You know, people haven't. We hear about it all the time. You know, you could be 30, you could be in the middle of something, and you'll have a little anxiety attack or various things where, as Alan rightly describes it, it's kind of like the wheels falling off a bit. But I kind of kept that private, obviously, for a long time. So, and you see, I drank quite a bit as well, which was all part of the story to keep everything going, you know.
Yeah.
But not, you know, not in a way that I was falling around the place. But I had to do something to help me to survive. And when I was 45, I had been going to psychotherapist called Mike Frawley in Galway, who was wonderful. This was after I stopped drinking, you know, because then the spectres start to really loom, you know, you start facing responsibilities. And it was there that I really knew there was something seriously wrong. But I wrote it all up in my diaries, and then I put the diaries away for 10 whole years without ever looking at them. And it was at this time when we were making meetings with Ivor that I finally got the courage to look at that diary again. And that's where Alan, that's where we kind of picked up the story.
Okay. And, so tell me about the regression therapy with Ivor then and what happened.
The actual regression therapy started with Ivor because I had known Ivor as a friend, and it was through a number of sessions with Ivor that I cracked the whole, I got back into a part of my life that wasn't just forgotten. It was actually locked out. It's what's called, it's what's known as unexperienced experience, because as a child, you are so overwhelmed with something like child sexual abuse that you have no place to put it. So it actually gets stuck in the mammalian brain, you know, the root of your brain. And it doesn't make its way into the memory system. So it takes very great skill to work with that. And Ivor, God rest him, he's just left us now, you know, last January. But he was just a master at that. And I think there's probably other people who'll be following in his footsteps, you know, to be able to do that with people.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You make that distinction between these are not repressed memories. It happened to you when you were a child, but you did not experience it. You experienced it for the first time with Ivor.
Correct.
through that.
Yeah. And that process is a difficult thing to get your head around. I understand that. Yeah.
And so what did you experience?
I kept a journal all through that whole period. So what I experienced in a nutshell was what happened in a room near my school.
With a particular
teacher.
And he was a brother.
He was a Christian brother at that time, yeah.
Yeah. And had you any inkling?
Oh, I had inklings all the way along. But it was almost like it was almost like a love affair or something, you know. As a small child, you know, it's all very confusing. The idea of somebody being inappropriately intimate with you. Very confusing and stays confusing right through one's life, you know.
Yeah, and look, Tomás, I appreciate that this is not easy, but it's complicated, isn't it? And this is not to suggest in any way that what happened was in any way complicated. It wasn't. It was very simple what happened here.
Yes.
But it just shows how manipulative an abuser can be in a way that you came away. Like, tell me about when he left the school. Tell me about that day. It's very telling.
Yeah. Well, it was just that he went around to say goodbye to everybody. He was leaving and he had his case up at the top and he had a brand new black suit on him. And he went around to shake hands with everybody. And I was sure he was going to kind of give me a little wink and say, you know, of course, you're special. Yeah. And he didn't. He just went through everybody and he's gone. And I was kind of devastated. But it's lovely what you said there, Brendan, that, you know, it's quite simple what happens. You see, what most of us are terrified of is, don't tell me what happened. Don't tell me the details. It's not that at all. You very correctly understand that it's an entire manipulative process that actually stays with a person for their whole life.
Yeah.
This low-grade fear that exists, that's planted as a seed by any abuser who's basically a very, very sick person, you know. These people are sick, and there's people listening to this radio interview maybe who are actually doing this, but they don't know they're sick. This is the depth of it, you know. So I think in making this film, what Alan and myself were trying to do was we went in and excavated this area ourselves. Alan as a filmmaker and as my friend, and me as the person who's trying to describe what happened. So we went away for a week, and it took all that length of time to kind of unravel and maybe tell the story. And then it took Alan and the editor, Bjorn McGuilla, to work for, you know, years have gone into the making of this film.
It's a big, brave decision, Alan, to make a film. Like, there's part of me goes, if you were Tomás's friend, would you say, don't do this? Like, do you know, are you sure you want to do this? Like,
absolutely, you know, and I was very hesitant in the early days. And initially we just discussed this as kind of friends and teased it out and the complexity of it. And to be honest, I was a bit dubious about this idea of regression until I learned more about it. But also, you know, one thing that struck me early in the conversation is that Tomás said to me, I was sort of in love with this man. And that struck me as kind of shocking, but also brutally honest, you know, which Tomás is in excavating his life. So it took a long time. We discussed it. I was hesitant about the film idea, but we discussed different things. At one point, we were looking at animation. Another point, we were looking at drama. We went round and round the circle. And eventually, it became clear that Tomás, like many survivors of childhood abuse, wanted to tell his story, wanted to be heard, and not just by me. And that set us in a path where finally, I suppose, this filmmaker and me decided, well, let's just do it. And during COVID, we set off for Glenstall Abbey, kind of went in retreat, and we were both kind of aware of the irony of that, that it was a religious retreat where we wanted to engage with this clerical abuse. But, you know, we spent a remarkable number of days down in Glenstall with Bob Brennan, our sound recordist, and literally just pieced together Tomás's life. And that was a remarkable privilege for me, you know. And as Tomás mentioned, he had these extraordinary diaries and notebooks, kind of obsessive chronicle of his life. And so we teased through them, and the film emerged out of that.
Yeah. It feels almost, Tomás, as if that what went on during the making of that film, are we actually eavesdropping on you processing and healing in your way there? Was it actually happening as the film was being made?
Absolutely. And the thing is, you see, I mightn't have been quite aware of it at the time, Brendan, but I am now looking back on it. It was an extraordinarily healing time. And the entire making of the film has been healing. It opened in the Cork Film Festival last November. So that's the first time Alan and myself sat in a cinema with, you know, a couple of hundred people.
What is that like for you?
It was absolutely brilliant. Now, I mean, Alan sat beside me and I, you know, I broke down once or twice maybe in it happening. But the privilege of having other people in a cinema looking at this with me was just extraordinary. So the healing thing that happened to me at that moment was quite extraordinary. And the thing is, I felt it was amazing. After it was all over, and people come up, I was just filled with this enormous love for everybody else. It was an extraordinary feeling, because it was out. It was released, and I've heard so many people on the radio down through the years, all the people who preceded me to break open this whole subject,
describing
their liberation. Exactly.
Yeah. Now, there is an interesting thing about this, though, Tomás, which is that, and Alan takes issue with this and challenges you on it in the film.
Yeah.
You have decided a particular manner of healing and of truth for you, right? And I suppose traditionally we would regard that justice and healing and closure in these situations as going to the law and taking that kind of a process. Yeah. You don't name your abuser. You call him ex, kind of. And you believe that if you went that route, it would actually impinge on your healing and on you telling your truth.
I'm absolutely certain that for me, other people take the route of going through the courts and going to the guards and everything. And I totally appreciate that. And the law is a very important thing. But somehow early on, and maybe it was part of the fact that we, as filmmakers, we have an opportunity to do something that not many other people have to do, to actually, you know, become our own reporters of our own stories, you know. So I had felt that it would be much better for me to actually, you see, I wouldn't get a chance in the court. If I went straight into a Garda station and reported it, I'd have to make a statement, and that statement would stand for perhaps 10 years. Without me ever being able to change it, without me ever being able to explore and process all of the stuff that I had to process, that would all be closed down to a degree. Now, I know that people who are going through this, you know, they would be going through psychotherapy alongside it. All that happens. But there's something for me about the fear that I have of the court process. The court process is, to me, is like a horror. So, you know, just read any legal document, you know, whereby, where to, for, not excluding, all this sort of stuff. For somebody who's been abused, that sort of language is entirely anathema.
What it sounds like is that the answer for you was not the prose of the legal system, that you needed a poetic response to handle the complexity and the humanity
of
it.
I had to sort it out for myself. I had to go through all my...
Alan challenges you in the film and says, well, you're not naming this person, but you're condemning him to guilt. I suppose what people might say as well is that if this guy is a perpetrator, there could be others, and that this person should be brought to justice.
Yes. Well, you see, it was a long, long time ago. One thing that I find very difficult, this is what I want to say really clearly, if I can.
Yeah.
People who abuse children are sick. They're very, very sick people, and they don't know it. We, as a society, naturally, at some stage, we want to run a mile. So we leave it to a process, a very detailed process that has evolved over the last few centuries. Yeah. So you see, the thing is, naming somebody just doesn't finish the whole thing. It actually opens up, it sets off torpedoes all over the place, which completely impinges on my healing, number one, because I'd be drawn into a whole other thing. Mm. As far as he's concerned, I'm saying his healing is his business, my healing is my business. The society is rife, we're riddled with abuse of all forms, domestic abuse.
Yeah.
Right this minute, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
People are listening to this who are engaged in this, and I'm just saying, please, let's have a little bit of space, you know, take away our hearts of stone and give us hearts of flesh.
And look, I know you would accept that, you know, these people are also criminals and everything, but this is your story.
And you know, there's people
there.
At home who are listening to this saying, like, how can you say that? And I totally understand it, because remember, I've been through every single step of the way. I wanted to kill this person. I wanted to strangle them. I wanted to do all that. How I feel about him now is actually, I actually, this sounds probably the hardest thing ever. What I'm after is love. Love is at the center of everything. It's the only thing that ever cures anything. It's the long way around. And I genuinely love everybody. I can say that. Haven't been through this whole process. This is where I end up. So I try to live my life now where I'm not actually harming anybody ever. I'm trying to help. And that's what this film is about, you know.
Sorry. But yet I do understand, you know, often during the process, I would feel the anger, which I expected to come out at the most. You know, I would say, let's just go to the guards. But I've learned through the most that that's not really the way for healing, you know. And of course, we respect anybody who goes the legal process, and that's vital. But it's a very, very difficult, very adversarial process for people who've been through hardship. And also, on the other side, sexual abuse of children is a sin, you know, if you want to look at it theologically. And yet the church, the institutions of the church, the religious orders, you know, it's very clear that what they do is legalistic, lacking in human healing, or any of the kind of spiritual aspirations that they claim. You know, it's a very, very dark and cynical system that the institutions of the church run.
The religious institutions have kind of lawyered up. They're protected by a wall of law. And I think I'm not trying to just pull down any castles or do anything. I'm just trying to say, let's be honest. You know, and I've heard people say, why can't they just come out with their hands up and help to see what can we do about this? You know,
one thing you did do is you wrote to him.
Yes.
What did you write to him?
Well, I actually wrote a few letters. And again, that's kind of part of the healing, you know. Mm. When this cracked first, I remember I rang my old psychotherapist, Mike Frawley, and I also talked to Alan about it at the time, because at this stage I was really like a rabbit between the headlights. And so the only thing I felt I could do was write a letter to him, dear. And I wrote it on, I think, Friday the 13th. And the tears flowed down my eyes as I wrote it. But of course, I never sent that. I think it was a good letter, like it was a good letter for me. So I think that writing those letters was part of my healing, you know.
Did you send any of them to him?
I did send one, yeah.
Roughly, what did you say in it?
It was a really very short one. And we didn't expect to get any answer, but I just felt at that time like I wanted to do it, and I've never got a reply. And I thought, I say in the film or something, you know, like, you know, if you got on well with the teacher and teacher was good a long time ago and you wrote to them, you know, the least they'd do is reply if everything was okay.
Yeah.
So it almost kind of tells me too that everything isn't okay. But, you know, it keeps coming back to this for me. When you ask me how do I feel about him, I actually, it's not my business anymore. I've kind of done my best to look after myself, and I want to continue, hopefully in some sort of way, to contribute to us all helping ourselves and one another together in this terrible spectre that's going on around us every single day, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd say too, Brendan, you know, this is a terribly dark subject and there have been dark days making this. But my memory of making the film with Tomás was a certain amount of joy. And I think it's worth noting that there's great hope in Tomás's story. You know, every time I watch the film, sometimes you get bored, which you always get bored with your own films. But when I look back on this, first of all, I see the remarkable courage of Tomás. But also, I always come away with a sense of hope. And hope is, you know, a very rare commodity in this world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are any of us looking for at the end of the day, really? If you ask this question, and I'm including perpetrators of sexual abuse and violence and everything in this, what are we looking for? We're looking for peace, every single one of us. So really the question is, how can we point all the cannons is the wrong word, you know, in that direction, as opposed to in this adversarial thing about, say, you're right, I'm wrong, all that sort of stuff. I learned in the process, because I went through all that, but as a society, we have to open up and listen a little bit more. Not have everything. The court is very important, but it doesn't all happen there. And psychotherapeutic rooms are very important. A lot of stuff happens there. But what I'd like to see is it happening in the broader world, because we all contribute to this silence. Silence is the biggest enemy. Silence is the thing that keeps the perpetrators in business. And I suppose that Alan and myself's film is actually breaking this silence. Like we took a great risk, like, and we're still taking a risk.
Yeah.
And the last thing
yeah.
I want to be doing is on the radio talking about having been abused.
Yeah.
It's like, but here I am. It's like I'm after waking up. Here I am talking to Brendan O'Connor and RT about something that I've never spoken publicly about. And we've made a film out of it.
And how are you feeling?
How am I feeling now?
Yeah.
I'm feeling fine. I'm actually, do you know something? I'm after just thinking, like, isn't it great, thanks be to God, that I'm on the radio talking to you? And isn't it great that you have shown such an interest in it? And isn't it great that Alan has shown such an interest in my story and used his craft to help people to, you see, people think going to this film, that's a bit grim, you know, people have said it already. A reviewer said, geez, I thought it was going to be a bit grim, but like it wasn't.
Yeah. Can I ask you about a bit that I was kind of unsure about it. So at the end of the film, you go in the car. I think the two of you, did you?
Yes.
So you knew where he lived.
Yeah.
And you go there. Can you explain it to me, Alan? What was in your mind?
Well, at the start of the film, Tomás just wanted to talk to this man. And it seemed at a certain point in the process in Glenstall, you know, I think at one point I ask him, how does this story end? And I suppose maybe the filmmaker in me wants to provoke that ending. So we drove close to where this person lives, not because we were going to bang on the door and confront him, but I felt we needed to move out of the safety and sanctity of the monastery and move into the real world. And I think it was very revealing to be that close, you know, to move into the real world and ask Tomás, well, how do you feel now? What do you want to do?
And how did you feel and what did you want to do as he approached near where he lived?
I actually felt nothing. I felt numb, which is totally, I suppose that's the way any survivor would identify with that, that you just nearly kind of close down again. But Alan very gently probed me. You know, and I discovered this is all live. This is the great thing about the film. It's happening as we watch, because we were on the hoof making this, like. And, you know, when Alan asked me that, I began to see, and I kind of describe it in some way, like, you know, if you were to meet an old lover, like, what would you, you know, sometimes we don't want to. We just say, look, because we've moved on, we've changed, and, you know. Yeah. So I just felt, I was glad that I went up. And I'm not trying to spook the guy out. And I do have to say, and this is I'm just throwing this as a small thing in, but it is the truth. There was more than one abuser in that school. And you know, I do talk about one of them already, but that yeah. it was just common, you see, because they were very sick men, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, do I want to meet a sick man now?
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
Not necessarily, but, you know, if I had to, I would. I think if I had to, I would. Because of having gone through this process, and especially making the film, I think I have a much greater accommodation now for the, as Alan says, it's a very dark place. And you'd say, who the last person you want to meet? But really, thanks be to God, I think I would say I would be happy to meet anybody.
What would you say to him? If for all we know, he's alive and listening now.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would you say to him?
I would say, do you have any comprehension of what the consequences of what you did are? And I think that's where it begins from then, because you see, most people are in denial about this. You know, you see people going through the courts and they'll swear blind that this never happened right up to the very last minute until they end up in prison. Very few of them end up in prison, by the way, like a very tiny, which says something about the process. But, you know, that's what I'd say. I would say, do you understand? Because, and then if the person was able to go there at least and understand it. And I feel so well now, Brendan, really, that I'd actually be fine. I'd be happy to discuss that with him. If he's, you know, if he can acknowledge it.
To help him.
Yes.
That's...
Well, I've already been helped, you see. I got the help from Alan and everybody else around. But let me say as well,
that's,
you see, here's the other thing.
I didn't get the help to heal, isn't it?
Yeah, but yeah. Let's just say I got it from psychotherapists. I got it from, God bless Ivor, God rest him.
Yeah.
And Alan and Mike Frawley and all of the other people and my family were extremely helpful, and, you know, my friends. But there's an awful lot of people who weren't helpful. And I think as a society, we stand back from it and let people at it. And that's something that we have to all consider. We have to all maybe, think about what are we doing anything to keep this circus going? You know, are we not doing something which could help to stem it even in any way? And most people think there's nothing you can do about it. It's been around from day one. It's not just happening in Ireland. It's happening globally. And now that there's, I hear it here on the radio and stuff, like immigration and there's sex trafficking, all this is going on. But who are we as a people? That's the thing. And who are we as individuals first? You know, take away our hearts of stone and give us hearts of flesh.
To survivors listening who maybe haven't managed to be as lucky as you and get to where you're at, what would you say to them about healing? Any advice?
I'd say keep going. You know? I think survivors are amazing people. They are the most resilient people in the world, because they've been up against it day in, day out when nobody knew it. And I know all these things, the silent terrors that go on and the. So I would just say to every single one of them, just keep going. Like, you know, there is that phrase, you know, when you're going through hell, keep going. But for me, I have found light at the end of the tunnel. I think I'm a better man today than I ever, ever was. And life itself, you know, the Buddhists say life is suffering, like, you know, it is. So let's get over it, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Also, if I could, I'd say to anyone, share your story. You don't have to make a film. This is an extreme example.
Of course, yeah.
With somebody you trust, quietly, because there's something about this terrible abuse which is about the negation of yourself. Whereas somehow, and I've seen it with Tomás, I didn't quite believe it, but I saw it in the end, that you can regain yourself by telling your story, even if it's to your closest friend, you know. So I think there is something, you know, don't suffer in the silence alone.
Yeah, regain.
And I would say to like people who are abusing out there that might even have a chink of light almost because they're suffering themselves, they're very sick people, maybe they would talk to somebody else as well.
Okay. You say that you would say to him about the consequences of, do you see the consequences of what you did? But he did not ruin your life.
thanks be to God he didn't, but he could have. And yeah. again, this is where we should really have a moment of silence for all the people who aren't with us anymore, whose life have been ruined and maybe ended up through taking their own lives or through illness in later life, you know. And I really do want to think about those people this minute and everybody around them, these people. It's hard to think about those people who are no longer here.
And also, if I can say, you know, it didn't ruin Tomás's life. He's a vibrant, wonderful person. But he's often said to me that it took away aspects of his life. And I think we shouldn't forget that.
Yeah.
Even when people like Tomás have come through.
Tomás, do you grieve now for that first 55 years for who you could have been and the life you could have had? Or do you just accept that this is where I'm at and this is how it played out?
Yeah, no, I just accept it. But what I do grieve for is the people who didn't make it.
The others. Yeah. You know some of them, do you?
We all do.
Yeah.
You know, if some of the people who are perpetrating these acts could actually cry, maybe like I'm crying now.
Yeah.
It could be a great relief, you know, because I really don't believe I have evil and good in me. I accept that, you know, I'm not a saint by any means. And I've done a lot. There's loads of things that I'm not proud of that I did throughout my life, because everybody has evil and good. But somehow we're kind of trying to think, well, we can only, and this is a legacy of the church and our education coming up through, that you can only be right, do the right thing, you know. But the people who do the right thing, the people who do the wrong thing know a lot more about the right thing than the people who do the right thing all the time. And we were told so often that we could do nothing except the right thing all the time. And that is bound to create all sorts of conditions where people become perverted, let's say. So we have to draw all that back and say we all have evil and good in us as individuals and as society. So let's accept that. And I think that might be of some help to the people who are so sick that they are abusing young children.
Okay. Tomás Hardiman, thank you so much. And look, Tomás, I know that was not easy, but I think it was very, 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 very useful. And I'm grateful to you and Alan Gilson, and thank you very much. The film is called The Days of Trees, and it is absolutely extraordinary and not grim at all. And it's screening all this week at the Irish Film Institute. And then you can see it at the Palace and also the Eye Cinemas in Galway and the Triskel in Cork in the coming weeks too. And it's also up for Best Documentary at the IFTAs next week. So good luck with that. Guys, thank you both so much. Tomás, thank you.
Thank you.
And if you've been affected by any of the issues in that conversation and you'd like to talk to someone, you can go to rte.ie/helplines.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.